consultation on hermeneutics at Drew University that we regard this as a most auspicious occasion for our interests and activities here. We have on the platform tonight some of the most redoubtable men-at-arms engaged in the battles of our contemporary thought world. We're also aware that there are many equally doughty champions in the audience who are similarly engaged. And all of us are at least active spectators and watching the dust as it is raised and waiting for it to settle a bit to see what is really going on. I want, in connection with this, to say two words before we move to the principal business of the consultation. The first is a word about the way in which the consultations have developed, and the second is a word about the theme which will interest us in the hours and days which lie before us. The first consultation on hermeneutics was held 4 years ago in April of 1962. It had no special theme. It was simply called a consultation on hermeneutics. In other words, hermeneutics was the theme for that consultation, and it took its rise against the background of discussions in the realm of theology as such. We invited to that consultation two men who were engaged in this discussion on the continent in Europe, Professors Gerhard Ebeling of the University of Zurich and Professor Ernst Fuchs of the University of Marburg. From this country, two others delivering major addresses at that time included James Robinson from the Southern California School of Theology and Amos Wilder of Harvard Divinity School, who is also with us in this consultation. This consultation proved to be of enormous stimulus and benefit to all of those who participated. And so useful and so exciting was it that it was decided that we should follow it up with a second consultation. Second consultation was to be based upon themes which arose out of the discussions at the first one. And so the second one, held 2 years later in April of 1964, was called a consultation on hermeneutics, but had as its subordinate, or indeed as its central theme, the problem of non-objectifying thinking and speaking in contemporary theology. The men whom we invited from abroad for this occasion were both from the University of Basel. One was Professor Heinrich Ott, and the other was Professor Fritz Bury. We were particularly eager to have Professor Ott because the theme which we had selected actually arose out of the preoccupations of the discussion in the first consultation in 1962. And some of the papers which had appeared in the first volume of the New Frontiers in Theology series, edited by Professors James Robinson and John Cobb, had featured an essay by Professor Heinrich Ott, which was entitled, What is Systematic Theology? And in this essay, he had proposed the availability for theological speaking and saying of the later work of the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. We decided that this was worth following up and that we should attempt two consultations, not one. We should have the first consultation dealing specifically with this theological problem of the possibility of a non-objectifying thinking and speaking in theology, and that the second one should extend the scope of our concerns and admit into the discussion perspectives of a non-theological kind, specifically perspectives from the disciplines of philosophy, literary criticism, and depth psychology. The discussions in the second consultation cried out for further discussion in this area. In addition to Professors Heinrich Ott and Fritz Bury from the University of Basel, we had major addresses from Professor Hans Jonas of the New School of Social Research, from Professor Schubert Ogden of SMU, and Professor Paul Van Buren, also from Texas. A very interesting thing developed in the course of these discussions. The discussion which began with a paper of definitions and questions which Martin Heidegger himself had submitted, raised initially the question as to the authentic availability of Heidegger's point of view. It was contested by Professor Hans Jonas. In the discussions which followed, the talk itself tended to fall apart in two directions. One in the direction of the availability of the work of Martin Heidegger, and the other in the direction of the questions raised by linguistic analysis in these times. Now, it seemed to us, as a result of reflection upon these discussions, that we were placed in a position where we needed to explore just what it is that language does, or what language is doing in our time, and to raise it from the side of Martin Heidegger first, particularly from his later work. We had observed that there were a number of contributions to this question from any number of perspectives, all dealing with the question of language in the form of metaphor or of symbol or of image, perhaps even of myth or discussions of the imagination. All of these as they would relate to our ways of knowing or our ways of thinking and speaking about ultimate reality. We thought the time had come when we should bring these people together. Many of these seemed to be working in isolation. We thought if we had gathered them about a table, so to speak, and permit discussion to take place, that the persons from these several perspectives would discover the areas which they had in common, the area of overlap. We would discover what questions might arise from authentic differences. And it was with this spirit in mind that we went to Martin Heidegger himself to enlist his cooperation in this enterprise. In short, after the first consultation, we proposed not one, but two. The first having to do with the problem of non-objectifying thinking and speaking in contemporary theology. The second having to do with the problem of language as it is understood in the context of the nature of metaphor, symbol, image, and meaning. So we have come tonight to the second leg of this proposal. Martin Heidegger was very enthusiastic about this. Indeed, he had hoped to come for these consultations. A matter of health prevented his coming, and more recently he has simply said that the time has come when he is too old to travel so far. It would be pleasant were he here, but I shall indicate in a moment some of the things which he said concerning these two proposals. We then have been interested in the question as to how theology is to be done in our time. We are interested also in the emergence of this question from the first hermeneutics consultation. We are interested further in the increasing ubiquity of the problem of language as such in contemporary philosophical and theological discussion. And in the fourth place, we are interested in the specific pointing up of the question of objectifying speaking and thinking in the essay of Professor Heinrich Ott already referred to. I might add one or two items parenthetically. The first would be to observe that the planning committee of the graduate school wished to sponsor or to foster conversations between continental and American thinkers. Secondly, that in pursuing these questions, the planning committee has sought not to underwrite any particular point of view, but rather to afford a place and a forum where points of view might talk together. And third, we have wished to focus not upon any particular point of view, but rather upon the problem as being a problem of central concern at the present time, with a hope that we might bring to bear upon it a variety of perspectives currently prominent in the discussion, both in Europe and in this country. It was felt at the time of the second consultation that the problem should be approached in the two stages which we have already mentioned, and the discussion with Martin Heidegger then gave rise to the following items. Now, I shall not summarize his contribution in any completeness, but rather call attention to are two or three items that relate to the discussions of this consultation. He wrote initially concerning the problem of non-objectifying thinking and speaking in contemporary theology. And he proposed that there were three themes which needed to be thought through in respect of this question. The first had to do with theology on its own account. It is obligatory to determine, above everything else, what theology as a mode of thinking and speaking has to discuss. Does theology have anything to discuss? Would be a possible implication of this statement. If it has, ought it not so to understand that which it has to discuss, as that it discusses it authentically and in terms that at least are subject to the verification principles implicit in its own mode and in its own manner? Secondly, he said it is indispensable to set out what is meant by objectifying thinking and speaking prior to a discussion of non-objectifying thinking and speaking. And he goes on to address himself mainly to this second question. The third theme he suggested was that it is obligatory to decide to what extent the problem of a non-objectifying thinking and speaking is a genuine problem at all, whether something is not thereby inquired after, the interrogation of which only thinks past the subject matter, distracts from the theme of theology, and unnecessarily complicates it. This then is the alternative at the opposite extreme from the first theme which he proposed. It would be possible to discuss the possibility of non-objectifying thinking and speaking in such a way as to commit an objectification in the very course of talking about it theoretically. And this is a danger which he was astute enough to call to our attention. Now today, he says, the danger exists and is growing that the scientific, technological mode of thinking is expanding to all areas of life. The false impression that all thinking and speaking is objectifying is thereby enhanced. And he goes on to protest that not all thinking and speaking is of the objectivizing kind. And of course, we know from his later work that he is specifically interested in exploring the possibilities of a non-objectifying kind of thinking and speaking. I call attention to the language that he has used here. He comes down upon the objectifying results implicit in a scientistic or technologically committed kind of linguistic use, and suggests that we have almost unwittingly, almost unconsciously, arrived at the point where this is the kind of language that we use, that whatever kind of language we think we are using, it is nevertheless either obsessed with or presupposed by conscious or unconscious commitments to a view of reality that insists upon accurate thinking being subject to the tests of objectifying speech. Now, his answer to this is perhaps a little complicated, yet it is essential as a backdrop to what we are about to undertake. We might ask, what is meant by objectifying speaking and saying? Keeping in mind that the second question as to the kind of language that we are about to discuss arises out of this background. The term objectifying is, in the first place, a present transitive verb. It refers to something that is taking place or is in the course of taking place. Something that is occurring in our own thinking and speaking, whether we are aware of it or not. We are not then talking about language in the sense that it is language about something, but language which, by the mode of its functioning, is committing objectification or reification upon that which is the experienced content of that particular subject matter. Now, this, I think, is his major concern, and he has gone to great pains in his work to run down the sources of the development of this pattern of objectifying thinking and speaking. In such talking about God, for example, we may ask whether we are using language which, because of its mode of functioning, represents a, quote, looking at function, whether it converts or transforms God into an object, or transforms what Tillich called the God beyond God into an object, thereby making of God a term subject to my manipulation in an objectifying rhetorical mode which subordinates God's statements to the logic or grammar of the syllogistic, propositional, mathematical, technological, or scientistic mode. It forms or reforms or formulates God across the sonic barrier of experienced relatedness, whether in its dramatic or, to use a Heideggerian term, its correspondence mode, into the formal relationships of a logos that is logic-bound, and through which the saying thinking identity is converted into the formal principle of identity. Theology also, in this mode, transforms its God terms, committing objectivization upon them, whereby the entire systematic expression may become, existentially speaking, idolatrous. Thus, in the name of God, or even in the name of Christ, idolatry may unwittingly be committed, then canonized in order to authorize its power against existential encroachments, which would see through experience the discrepancy between the experience and the formulation of the experience. Then these canonized expressions gradually become identified with Christianity itself, and then are finally rejected by men generally as being empty, without power to reconcile, or dead, as the current saying is, and in fact not comparable with the elemental wonders of experience in the world as given. In this way, the message of Christian faith is easily trapped in the modes of objectifying discourse. In discourse, that is, where the meaning is being carried away from experiential and existential relationships in which correspondence in the spirit resides, and into the objectifying and rigidifying modes of logic-stratified discourse. Here, language is the vehicle of depletion. Speech is entrained toward deprivation of its own significances. Now, Heidegger accounts for this by way of what he has termed the forgetfulness of being, a forgottenness that enters into the Western way of thinking and speaking, even from the time of Greek metaphysical speculation. Even in Plato, even in the allegory of the cave, he sees this long trek beginning. In the allegory of the cave, he points out, Plato treats truth as a function of the subject's point of view, and truth becomes a question of the correctness of one's view. As though in the long tendency to place the subject over against the object, whether in the Platonic or the Cartesian modes, we unwittingly take the stance that the truth is at our disposal, that we stand over against it and confer upon it its status, its value, and the like. Now he argues that in the development of this tendency, we have moved all the way down to the point where in our time, this tendency has reduced our linguistic expectations to the level of technological successes and scientific expectations. He says we must get back behind the intellectualistic rationalist tradition, what he terms metaphysics, to the atmosphere of wonder out of which the pre-Socratic thinkers thought. Now, moving very, very quickly here, one cannot rehearse the entire corpus of Heidegger's work, we come to the point of connection with our present discussions. If we take Heidegger at his word and look back behind the intellectualist tradition at the pre-Socratic thinkers, we find a most amazing and extraordinary appeal to metaphor whenever they attempt to talk about that reality which is beyond the grasp of the customary reflective analytical modes. Phusis loves to hide, said Heraclitus. And his primary metaphors, fire, the bow, the lyre, the logos, the fountain, all accord to being two things. First, its mystery from which we start, and second, its summons or its language to which we respond. Now, the second of these would perhaps be of primary interest to us. But it suggests that logos, as a metaphor held by Heraclitus, took the active form of utterance, as though the whole of being, the whole of reality, were characterized by utterance, by expression, the utterance of everything that is, and we in the midst of that uttering. Or if we took his metaphor of the fountain, here we have a figuration of the perpetual movement of that which is, where isness is constantly is-ing. The fountain represents the initiative on the part of being prior to our initiative in appraising it, responding to it, naming it, and the like. Or to use Spinoza's figure of the tree, Spinoza argued that we should trace back the data of experience along the branches to the trunk of the tree and so down to the roots. And in that way, we'd be getting at the metaphysical foundation of the experience of the branches of the tree. Heidegger says this is the trouble with metaphysics. It hasn't gone back far enough, that the presupposition of these metaphysical presuppositions is not the roots of the tree, but that which the roots of the tree are rooted in, that is to say, the soil. Behind the notion of being is the primary mystery of being, the primary wonder that anything, whatever, is at all. And that is where the roots should be rooted. Now he feels that in our thinking, this is the step we have neglected, the step that we must resume. And if we are to resume it, he would suggest that it implies a radical revision of our ways of thinking and speaking in the West. Now, this raises then the problem most crucial, perhaps, to this consultation, the question as to the uses of metaphor, symbol, image in their relation to meaning. Heidegger holds that there may be a non-objectifying language. Our problem initially, then, is to be made aware of the way in which we unwittingly reinstate the forms that are spent, even at the point of our awareness of the problem. Ours is a transitional phase. As I once heard someone remark that this was a quotation from Adam addressed to Eve as they were going out of the garden. Ours is a transitional phase. Heidegger says it belongs to the nature of such transitions that they, to a certain extent, must still speak the language of what they are helping to overcome. This is our embarrassment in discussing this problem. Or as Wittgenstein put it, a picture held us captive, and we could not get outside it, for it lay in our language, and language seemed to repeat it to us inexorably. The habit, the pattern, the mode is already implicit in our language, and even when we become aware of it, it is still very difficult to talk without reinstating the problem to which we are addressing ourselves. Thus, we are in the awkward position, perhaps similar to that of Aesop's fly on the axle tree of the chariot. The fly was riding there, and the chariot was going down the road and kicking up a great dust. The fly turned around and saw this enormous dust back there, and his little chest swelled up with pride, and he said, "My, what an enormous dust I do raise." And we are apt to be in that position, raising an enormous rhetorical dust, meanwhile being carried forward in the same old axle tree of the chariot, not aware of the fact that we are being carried by the very point that we are trying to examine. Now, Heidegger, in response to this second question for this consultation, was very, very keen in his response to the theme which we proposed. You'll find this theme on your programs. It's that little quotation from Herdelin, which reads poetically, "Man dwells upon the earth." Here, I think we have the clue to the alternative kind of speaking and saying that was implied in his specification of the scientistic, technological kind, which he put down on the other side. And in his later work, the things that he says about poetry are all a kind of phenomenological investigation of what kind of speaking and saying this non-objectivizing kind might possibly be. In corresponding with him, I mentioned the third sonnet of Rilke in the first part of the Sonnets to Orpheus. And he wrote back at once and wanted to know what particular point we had in mind. The sonnet has in its background the venture of Orpheus down into Hades. I'll not go into other elements in the background, though they are relevant here. But the god referred to is Orpheus, and Orpheus' movement down into Hades. There, with the enchantment of his music, it was possible for him to bring the enchanted one back out, provided he could trust in the music alone and not look over his shoulder to see whether she was really coming. Now, here are the lines. A god can do it, but how, tell me, shall a man follow him through the narrow lyre, the musical instrument? His mind is cleavage. At the crossing of two heartways stands no temple for Apollo. Song, as you teach it, is not desire, not suing for something yet in the end attained. Song is existence. Dasein. Song is existence. Easy for the god. But when do we exist? And when does he spend upon our being the earth and the stars? Youth, this is not it, your loving, even if then your voice thrusts your mouth open. Learn to forget your sudden song. That will run out. Real singing is of a different breath, a breath for nothing, a wafting in the god, a wind. Now, he made some comments upon this. One, poetry may serve as an example of excellent, non-objectifying thinking and speaking. Two, in his Sonnets to Orpheus, Rilke says in a poetic way what it is that determines the thinking and saying of the poet. Three, song is existence. See my essay in Holzwege, pages 292-5. Four, song, the singing saying of the poet, is not desire, not suing or wooing for that which in the end is attained as an effect through human performance. Six, poetic saying is being there. This word Dasein is used here in the traditional sense of metaphysics. It means presentness, presentness. Poetic saying is to be present near or for the god. Presentness means the simple readiness which does not expect anything and does not reckon or calculate success. To be present at or near means the sheer permitting of the presence of God to be said to me, or the pure letting itself speak of the presence of God. In such saying, there is nothing being posited and represented as Gegenstand or as object. Nothing is found here which a compassing and encompassing representation could place over against itself. a breath for nothing. Breath stands for the breathing in and out, for the letting itself speak to me, an acceptance which responds to that which is being said to me. There is no need for an extensive exposition in order to make clear that the question for a thinking and speaking which is doing justice to a subject matter is based upon the question concerning the being, or capital B, or the being, small b, which in any given instance manifests itself. Being as presentness can show forth itself in different modes of presence. Now, throughout, the term presence is the persistent one. And the metaphor of breathing would seem to suggest that over against that ungraspable meaning, that ungraspable being, which is the presupposition of metaphysical being, the soil about the roots, that to this we are to be in response, and that the poet's aim is so to speak in response to being uttered into, as that what he says shall co-respond with that which he is answering to. If when one went to bed each night, one would suddenly think, well, now, if I go to sleep, maybe I'll stop breathing. I'd better stay awake, therefore, while I sleep, in order to be sure that I keep breathing all the way through the night. But we accept this. We let the breathing breathe. We let the being be, in order that the soil about the roots may continue this expression in this form of presence, or this mode of presence. And this again becomes a metaphor for what Heidegger seems to be reaching after here. Now, I think perhaps we need say very little more by way of introduction. How do we manage this? How do we talk about it? If we were to try to philosophize in this context, how would we do it? If we were to try to theologize in this context, what would it do to our modes of theological thinking? If we were to try to accommodate our lives to this kind of letting the ultimate presence presence itself, what would it do to our existential modes of behavior? If we try to formulate some witness to our experience that can be written down, if we try to talk about the soil, about the roots, what kind of metaphor will cross over from that which we call the known into that which mysteriously is at once the unknown, at the same time that which unconceals itself, as Heidegger says? These are the questions. To put it quite simply, to turn to the models for our thinking, we would not here be thinking in terms of a kaleidoscope, as though reality were like a kaleidoscope that is being shaken continuously, yet always conforming to a geometric hexagonal oneness. It would be more like the fountain of Heraclitus, the fountain that founts, wherein I am a part of the fountain's continuous expression, and to this extent, fate-laden, as Heidegger says, and I must respond to it. Truth, therefore, is that which is unconcealed or unveiled, and yet that which remains discreetly within the mystery of its own integrity. We will be content that Phusis, to some extent, should continue to remain hidden. We would think then, not so much by analogy as by correspondence through response, and our language would become a response to being's call. Heidegger says many things now from this point on. Says that language, in this sense, becomes the house of being. To what extent do we, through our naming, construct the house of being? Are the timbers of the house metaphorical, imagistic, symbolistic, mythological? Do we construct through the imagination? What is the relation of the imagination to our experience of the real and to our modes of defining? Herderlin says, poetically, man dwells upon the earth. Does this imply that I project the house in which I dwell? Or do I project it by way of and by reason of a prior response to that which has already been addressed to me through the primal utterance, the primal language? Is my language then basically an answer to the summons of being? Is there a sense in which language is prior to speech? In reading a poem, therefore, Heidegger, and this, I would say, becomes the analog that he proposes, Heidegger would say that the reader of the poem does not undertake an historical critical exegesis if he wants to get the real sense of the poem. He enters into dialogue with the poem about the subject matter to which the poem has admitted him. The poet's word is not the object of his study, but is an event presenting a subject matter that calls forth a response from the reader. Exegesis or eisegesis are in this case quite secondary. The crucial question is whether the reader succeeds in entering into the movement of the poet's own words, which express the experience of the subject matter. Does he hear the call of being to which the poet's words were an answer? Does he hear them clearly enough to become himself an answer by way of the poet's answering? The understanding, hermeneutics, of a text consists in this kind of hearing. Thus, hermeneutic retains its godly heritage. Hermes was the messenger of the gods, and his messages were, in some sense, again, fate-laden. Interpretation is the seeking of the word, or the word behind the words, of the messenger. Just as there is a poem behind the poems, as Heidegger says, a poem that is never written, but which may be described through the profile of the many poems that the poet writes, so the theologian may speak of the word behind the words. But in doing so, what kind of speaking are we employing? What mood of utterance are we engaged upon? Let me conclude with another line from Herderlin, his Friedensfeier, rather an unusual statement. He says, "The law of destiny is this, that all things must come to themselves, in order that, when stillness returns, they be also a tongue." Now, it's a little difficult, but it would seem to suggest that what Heidegger is speaking of here, by way of the analogy of the poetic mode, ties in quite well with the view of the world that we have presented to us today, and also ties in quite well with the new understanding of ourselves that we are learning by way of the data of depth psychology. Or to put it in another way, this would seem to suggest that although we may be, cosmologically speaking, but the minutest minuscule of dust on a grain of sand tossed in a galactic sea, psychologically, pneumatologically, ontologically, the whole is given in the part, and we are permitted from the deep centrum of our existence in its response to being to be both the eyes of becoming and a tongue for utterance, the manifest of glory and the resonance of praise. Now, I have only suggested that we have a good deal to talk about, and I have attempted merely to indicate that our concern is with a radical break with the way in which we have been doing and saying. I have tried to retain the continuity on the theological side with the previous consultations, but to point also to the areas in which our previous discussion seemed to direct our attention in order that we might now engage in conversation, or as we say, dialogue, between these several perspectives at the point where our mutuality of concern establishes a focus for talk. Before introducing our speaker of the evening, I would like to introduce the gentleman on the platform. I will not tell you about them now. Various chairmen will tell you more about them as they appear and take part. I will simply follow the program and ask each one to rise as I read his name so that you will know who he is and where he is sitting. And those who are not yet here will be introduced in due course. May I present then, first of all, Professor Heinrich Ott, who was here with us 2 years ago from the University of Basel. Professor Amos Wilder, who has been here at each of the consultations from Harvard Divinity School. Professor Arthur McGill, who was with us 2 years ago from Princeton University. Professor Beda Alemán has come from the University of Würzburg. We're happy to welcome him, Professor Alemán. Professor Vincent Vichinas, whose book has been used extensively in seminars at Drew, from Prince George College in Canada. Professor Wolfgang Zucker from our neighboring Uppsala College. Mr. Kenneth Burke of Drew University. The next gentleman was introduced earlier this evening, and the chairman said that he felt that he really belonged to us, though he is listed here as coming from Brandeis University. He comes from London, and he comes from Brandeis University by way of Drew University. Mr. Owen Barfield. Professor Ray Hart really belongs to Drew University. Professor Ray Hart, now of Vanderbilt. Miss Denise Levertov, Drew University. Father William Richardson, now of Fordham University, was with us 2 years ago. Professor Gabriel Vahanian of Syracuse University participated 2 years ago. Professor Ira Progoff of Drew University. Professor Harry Slockauer of Drew University and the New School for Social Research. Now I want to introduce one more person and let you relax for a moment, and then we'll introduce our speaker of the evening. I'd like to introduce our warden for the consultation. He is the man on whom all the burdens of the consultation fall. Any information that you may desire, anything you want to get done. He is a man of a verified omnipotence and possibly omniscience. I would like to present Professor Howard Key. He might want to make some announcements. I'll
make making any announcements until tomorrow. I think that's the kindest thing I can do.
It is an unusually great pleasure to present to you tonight Professor Norman O. Brown from the University of Rochester. We have had the pleasure of having him at Drew on previous occasions, and it's an unusual delight and always a unique experience to have him with us again. Dr. Brown received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Balliol College in Oxford University in 1936 and his doctorate from the University of Wisconsin in 1943. He was professor of language at Nebraska Wesleyan University from 1942 to 1943. He was instructor and professor at Wesleyan University from 46 to 63 or 4, I'm not sure just which. He's a Commonwealth Fund Fellow. He is a Ford Foundation Teaching Fellow, a Guggenheim Fellow. He's the author of three books, the most notable, perhaps, of which to date is the book Life Against Death. Now, these are incidental things, really, to his appearance here tonight. I discovered that for 3 years he served as a research analyst with the Office of Strategic Services, quote, pressing the cloaks and sharpening the daggers, close quote. And judging from his pattern of life since that time, his number was probably 000666. I thought that in view of the redoubtable company seated here that I ought to introduce him as a St. George out after the dragon. But on second thought, I couldn't quite figure out which was the dragon. Then it occurred to me that it would not be inappropriate to appeal to another historical figure. Professor Brown has all the splendors, and he wears the rhetorical plumes of an authentic Don Quixote. And I say this in the highest praise, and I always use this ascription with great reverence, ever since I read that Stephen Leacock once remarked that he would much rather have written Don Quixote than the whole of the Institutes of John Calvin. Now, there is yet another possibility. He is a Dionysian Christian, and I think there is a sense in which he, in our time, has gone down like Dionysus into Hades, there to weigh the merits of all the poets and metaphysicians and theologians and other men of eminence who might have been corralled there, whom he will bring back from this venture. We yet wait to see. I may indicate that he has a new book almost ready for release, that his remarks tonight will reflect, if not indeed recapitulate, much that is in that volume. It's an uncommon pleasure to have Dr. Brown with us, and it is with considerable pride that I present him again to you now, Professor Brown.
If it wasn't an unusual pleasure to be at Drew, I wouldn't be here. Because what I have to say, or my ability to speak at all, is severely restricted at present. And I have to define in all candor exactly what I have to give. I have material that will, I hope in a few months, be published, and that's to say worthless. Apologize for this fact in the presence of other people who are able to write fresh things. I'm not able to write fresh things because I have exhausted myself in this book, which will be published. And I have a section of that book to read to you tonight. A section, the book is to be called Love's Body. One of the people I met was John Donne. And this comes from late in that book. I'm not worried about any possibility that the subject matter might presuppose preceding subject matter in the book. The book is not that coherent. But I am concerned about the way I'm going to use words, or the way I'm going to use language this evening, the way I'm using language towards the end of this book, which is different from the way I used language in Life Against Death, and even different from the way I used language at the beginning of this book, so far as I understand what's going on. Perhaps you would, I can say that late in life I discovered that poetically man dwells on earth. Or sero te amavi o pulcritudo tam antiqua et tam novel, sero te amavi. In any case, I really do believe, and I think the introductory remarks of Dean Harper point this way too, I really do think that the real question for this conference, for this meeting, is not what we say, but how can we say it, or how can we say anything, how can we speak at all about the unspeakable, I mean the unconscious. So please look on this, perhaps primarily, as an experiment in language, or the way to talk about some of these things which we all think about and feel about. As far as subject matter is concerned, both in beginning and in ending, I would like to particularly put myself down as one who regards Owen Barfield as a great authority. Let me say, define the subject matter initially as symbolism versus literalism. Let me define the subject matter theologically as the letter versus the spirit. 2 Corinthians 3:6, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. That is to say, spiritual or symbolical interpretations versus literal meanings, it is still a matter of life against death. But also, biblically and scripturally speaking, bondage to the letter versus freedom of the spirit. The goal is still liberation. Liberation and renewal. Romans 7:6, newness of spirit and oldness of letter. A new age, perhaps the third age, the age of the spirit prophesied by Joachim of Fiore. A new age, which would be the end of the old, the end of the Protestant era, the end of the world. Let me begin with the end of the world. The chapter or section in front of me now is called Judgment. That is to say, the last judgment, but also the subject matter of Kant's critique of judgment. That is to say, the form of the sentence, any sentence, or every sentence, a last judgment. The fulfillment of prophecy is the end of the world. Figures are always figures of last things. Typology or symbolism is eschatology. The rending of the veil, the breaking of the seal, is the end of the world. History is fulfilled in its own abolition. 2 Corinthians 3:12 to 14. Seeing then we have such a hope, we use great freedom of speech, and not as Moses, who put a veil over his face, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. But their minds were blinded, for unto this day remaineth the same veil unremoved in their reading of the Old Testament, which veil is abolished in Christ. To bring this world to an end, it is the consummation devoutly to be wished, the final judgment. The revolution or revelation, the apocalypse, is vision which pronounces a last judgment and brings about the end. Aphorism is the form of last judgments, sentences. It is a fiery consummation. Truth is a blaze, and error or creation will be burnt up. It is burnt up the moment men cease to behold it. Symbolic consciousness, a trance in transit, going over from this world to the next, overcoming this world. Overcoming this world, abolishing it. The fulfillment is the abolition. Having filled deficiency, he abolished shape. The shape is the cosmos, a shape to which deficiency has been subjected. For the place in which there is envy and dissension is deficiency, but the place which is unity is plenitude. The universe as we see it, reality or the reality principle, a set of definitions or boundaries, and where there is definition, there is division. But thank heaven, the shape of this world is transitory. Overcoming the world. That is to say, overthrowing the government. Overthrowing the government of the reality principle. The reality principle, which is the prince of darkness, the ruler of the darkness of this world. We struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world. The reality principle is the power principle, realpolitik, the keeper of the prison. To liberate flesh and blood from reification, overthrow the reality principle. Instead of reification, perishable form. Truth will not stand or stay or keep. It is nothing to be had or hoarded or passed from hand to hand. It is no commodity or store of past labor. It is either new or not at all. The form of the sentence is transience. It must go under. Out of this world, out of Vanity Fair, out of the marketplace. Put the mind out of business. Words are to be redeemed, to be taken out of the marketplace. The Greek word is ex agoradzestai, to cease to be a commodity, to be removed from circulation, to be taken out of circulation, out of the flow of currency, out of the universe of discourse, into the immovable prajna, the perfectly still mirror, to condense, to crystallize, to become a parable. Words taken out of time into eternity. Aphorism is the form of eternity. From this world to the next, from utility to creation. Instead of words as marketplace utilities, brand names to advertise established items, the creative words that make it so. Words made new again, as on the first day of creation, eternity's sunrise. Words used not to interpret the world, but to change it. Not to advertise this world, but to find another. To pass from this world to the next, to pass from ordinary to extraordinary language. The permanent revolution, the permanent reformation, is vision, is spontaneity, perpetually renewed. Every day, the last day or the first day, the beginning and the end. People are wont to speak of the necessity of a new order of things. Men in the grip of their personal ego and of the time that adheres to it can only give birth to an old order. A new order is, correctly speaking, one which is renewed hourly. Permanent revolution, then, and no permanent reified visible structures issuing from contract, commitment, promise, will, willpower, all of which are from the ego. Not voluntarism, but spontaneity or grace, not the ego, but the id. Take but degree away, 'tis the end of the world. The reality principle is the importance principle, which commands us to be fooled by appearances, to respect the emperor's new clothes. Hierarchy is visible. In the invisible kingdom it is that the first are last. Overthrow the reality principle, no respect for persons, not to be fooled by masks, no clothes, no emperor. All power is an impostor, a paper tiger or idol, burnt up the moment men cease to behold it. The last judgment is vision. The political act is the poetical act, the creative vision. To see is to see through. Political organization is theatrical organization. That public realm where, as Hannah Arendt says, appearance, something that is being seen and heard by others as well as by ourselves, constitutes reality. That's the public. To see through this show, to see the invisible reality, to put an end to politics. The emperor's no clothes. Things hidden from the wise and revealed to babes. The learning to be unlearned. The simplicity to be acquired. The great, the terrible simplification, the last judgment. The blindness is from blinkers of decorum. Apocalypse strips away the decent draperies on which the whole big lie depends, the false front, the screen or wall that separates the public sphere from the private parts. In the whole modern period, the emergence of housekeeping from the shadowy interior of the household into the light of the public sphere, erasing the old boundary between private and political. Psychoanalysis is that revolving stage which completes this revolution, disclosing the bedroom and the bathroom behind the bourgeois facade, disclosing the obscenity of the onstage scene, abolishing the reality principle and its unreal distinction between public and private, between head and genital. Power politics is pissing in public, Freud says, the connection between ambition and urethral erotism. Together with the lofty principles that scotomize, cover with a thick wall of darkness that human scene. Overthrow the importance principle, turn it upside down. Put down the mighty from their seats and exalt them of low degree. Every throne a toilet seat and every toilet seat a throne. Psychoanalysis, the visionary sans-culottism. The distinction between the sublime and vulgar abolished. Sublimation swallowed up in symbolism. As above, so below. Go high-low every time. Upside down. The paradox is a reversal of fortune, a humiliation of the power principle, precisely a crucifixion. At the intersection of this world and another world, the wisdom of this world is crossed up. And at this crossroads, there is a temple. As Luther says, our good is hidden, and so profoundly is it hidden that it is hidden under its own opposite. Thus our life is under death, love of ourselves under hate of ourselves, glory under ignominy, salvation under perdition, justice under sin, strength under infirmity, and universally, every one of our affirmations under its negation. Dialectics is apocalypse, reversal, or awakening from the dead. The power of the foolishness of the cross. The power which is beyond the power principle, which comes after the power principle is broken. Truth in the form of weakness and foolishness, having no powerful arguments, having no arguments at all. Theologia mystica non est argumentativa. Truth is not on the side of the big battalions. Truth is not on the winning side. Truth is beyond the reality principle, in another world where the distinction between victor and vanquished vanishes. Truth comes empty-handed, in its poverty is its strength. Truth comes riding a donkey. Like psychoanalysis, like Hamann, finding revelations in little, contemptible events, infinity in a grain of sand, or the sacrifice of Christ imprinted like a physical law on even the lowliest call of nature. As Dionysius says, it is more fitting that divine truths should be expounded under the figure of the less noble than of nobler bodies. For then it is clear that these things are not literal descriptions of divine truths, which might have been open to doubt had they been expressed under the figure of nobler bodies. Psychoanalysis does not make that mistake. Any event, any trivial event, any accident at the crossroads, regal tragedies, the Oedipus complex in every household, or the psychopathology of everyday life, or James Joyce, the tragic significance of everyday life, modern realism, the modern analog of medieval typology, which, by figural interpretation, discovered world historic significance in any event, an event which remains trivial for those who do not have eyes to see. Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. The event remains trivial for those who do not have eyes to see. And so God remains hidden, or rather an open secret. And everything is told in parables, that seeing they might see and not perceive. The mystery of meaning remains forever inviolate. There is no literal truth. Truth riding a donkey as foolishness, or as Isaiah says, he hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Or as Haman says, the divine style chooses the foolish, the shallow, and the ignoble to put to shame the strength and ingenuity of all profane writers. Dei dialectus soloicismus, the dialect of God is solecism, the foolish form to preserve the incognito. Like bread and wine. Everything is symbolic. Everything is holy. There is no special time or place or person privileged to represent the rest. And then democracy maybe can begin. The many are made one when the totality is in every part, or when one thing is taken up, all things are taken up with it. One flower is the spring. It is all there all the time. Infinity in a grain of sand. There is this humiliation or contraction in all symbolism or incarnation. Verbum breviatum, as Augustine says. The word had to be abbreviated in order to become flesh, or Freud would call it a condensation of meaning. Augustine says, containing the world, he suffered himself to be contained in a manger. Everything is a symbol, says Goethe, and while it perfectly presents itself, it points to everything else. In this posture, I see a combination of the highest presumption and the highest modesty. infinity in a grain of sand. All symbolism,
all hierophany is incarnation of meaning in matter or word made flesh, and incarnation is humiliation.
Being found in the form of a man, he humbled himself. To see symbolism is to see a humiliated God, to break with power and the power principle. Pascal sees this very clearly. He says in the Pensée, types. The letter kills. All happened in types. Here is the cipher which St. Paul gives us. Christ must suffer and humiliated God. Or in the East, though he is omniscient, Vishnu shows himself in material things as if he were without knowledge. Though a spirit, he appears material. Though truly God, he appears at the disposal of man. Though inaccessible to sense, he appears tangible. God is hidden under his own opposite. As incarnate, as God in the shape of man, most hidden when most there. Symbolism is this paradoxical coming together of sacred and profane, the coincidentia oppositorum, the true cross. To go beyond the reality principle, through the looking glass of dialectical reversal, to the absurd truth. Overcome this world by a reductio ad absurdum, or credo quia absurdum. From the shadow of typology to the night of paradox. Upside down, not the reality principle, but surrealism. Surrealism, a vertiginous descent into ourselves, a systematic illumination of the hidden places and a progressive darkening of the rest, a perpetual promenade in the forbidden zone. Go down and stay down in the forbidden zone with psychoanalysis, and don't reascend with Jung, Freud puts at the end of the history. Freud ends his history of the psychoanalytical movement by saying, I can only conclude with the wish that fate may grant an easy ascension to those whose sojourn in the underworld of psychoanalysis has become uncomfortable. May it be vouchsafed to others to bring to a happy conclusion their work in the depths. In the depths, below, the revolution is from below, the lower classes, or underworld, the damned, disreputable, despised, and rejected. The real motto of Freud in the interpretation of dreams is that revolutionary motto, flectere si nequeo superos acaruntum avebo. If I cannot bend the higher powers, I will stir up the lower depths. Freud's discovery, the universal underworld, which redeems our bourgeois characters from our bourgeois selves. Darkness at noon, a progressive darkening of the everyday world of common sense, as in Finnegan's Wake. Second sight is the dark night. Night gives light unto night. This is the double dark, or negation of the negation. And yet, the way up is the way down. Finally, it is to overcome the opposition of darkness and light, cleanliness and dirt, order and chaos, or the marriage of heaven and hell. Cusanus says Christ is within the wall of paradise, which is the wall of the law of contradiction. And Novalis says the destruction of the law of contradiction is the supreme task of a higher logic. This second section, last section, the title is Freedom. There is no doubt that if anyone takes the New Testament seriously, the telos is anarchy. 1 Corinthians 15:24. Then cometh the end, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and all power. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The break is a break in nature, or water from the rock. The natural order broken. The natural order is our construction and constriction. Freedom. Freud is the great emancipator from the reality principles. Free speech. Free association, random thoughts, spontaneous movements. We stumble on the truth. The truth is always scandalous, a stumbling block. Truth is where we stumble or fall down. Truth is in the rough ground, in the anomalies, not in the explanations. Search the scripture till you find a stumbling block, says Origen. Look for the slips of the tongue, says Freud. The lapsus linguae, the fortunate falls. The truth is in the error. We slip out from under the reality principle into the truth when the control breaks down. By great good fortune, gratis, gratis, and by grace, and not by our own work or will. It is a treasure stumbled upon suddenly, not gradually accumulated by adding one to one. The accumulation of learning, adding to the sum total of human knowledge, lay that burden down, that baggage, that impediment. Take nothing for your journey, travel light. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. The original mistake in every sentence, metaphor. Aristotle's definition of metaphor. Metaphor consists in giving the thing a name that belongs to something else. Gilbert Ryle's definition of metaphor. The presentation of facts of one category in the idiom appropriate to another. The original sentence, the original metaphor in the East, Tatvam Asi, thou art that, or Hoc est corpus meum, this is my body. Metaphor is mistake or impropriety, a faux pas, a slip of the tongue, a little madness, petit mal, a little seizure or inspiration. The original sense is nonsense, and common sense a cover-up job, repression. Psychoanalysis, symbolic consciousness, leads from disguised to patent nonsense, with Wittgenstein, with surrealism, with Finnegan's Wake. This is my body, a mistake, or magic, or madness, or child's play. This is a house, and this is a steeple. Wisdom is wit. In play, not in work. In freedom, not in necessity. A vast pun, as in dreams, or the neologisms of schizophrenia, or Finnegan's Wake, or the Old Testament prophets. Wisdom is in wit, in fooling, most excellent fooling, in play, and not in heavy puritanical seriousness, in levity, not in gravity. Feet off the ground, practice levitation. The god of Delphi, who always spoke the truth, never gave a straight answer in the upright in the upright Protestant way. He spoke in riddles, in parables, in ambiguities and temptations, that hearing they might hear and not understand. To teach is not to tell, is not to tell, like Heraclitus, the obscure. And the god knew how to lie, and so did not deceive his countrymen. The real deceivers are the literalists who say, I cannot tell a lie, or hypothesize non fingo. Literal meanings are packaged commodities for passive consumers. In symbolist poetry, the reader is incorporated into the work, actively participates in the poetic process itself. The connection is left for the beholder to work out for himself. All the Lord's people become prophets. It cannot be inculcated or imposed from without. Like faith or love, it cannot be forced. The spirit is free love. Enigmatic form is living form. Like life, an iridescence, an invitation to the dance, a temptation or irritation. No satisfying solutions, nothing to rest in, nothing to weigh us down. Meaning is in the play or interplay of light. As in schizophrenia, all things lose their boundaries, become iridescent with many colored significances. No things but an iridescence, a rainbow effect. Am farbigen Abglanz haben wir das Leben. An indirect reflection or refraction, a broken light or enigma. No things but an iridescence in the void. Meaning is a continuous creation out of nothing and returning to nothingness. If it is not evanescent, it is not alive. Everything is symbolic, everything is transitory or unstable. The consolidation of meaning makes idols. Established meanings have turned to stone. Meaning is not in things, but in between, in the iridescence or interplay, in the interconnections or at the intersections, at the crossroads. Meaning is transitional as it is transitory, in the puns or bridges, the correspondence. In the iridescence is flux, is fusion, subverting the boundaries between things. All things flow. In Christian art, earthly images may appear to melt away and vanish, since to the Christian no single phenomenon has the importance it did to the pagan. Here we have not the dualistic device of the Ciceronian simile, but metaphoric fusion. We are offered a parallel in the modern poetics by alchemy, exemplified in the practice of a Gongora, who may lead us by metaphors from a maid adorning herself for marriage to Egyptian tombstones, or we may think of the famous passage in which Proust, by the use of metaphors, transforms lilac into fountain, or of Valéry's Cimetière Marin, that sea cemetery which becomes successively a roof covered with white pigeons, a temple of time, a flock of sheep with a shepherd dog, a multicolored hydra. All this is based on the same Christian poetics of kaleidoscopic transformation of symbols. That's all a quote from Leo Spitzer. May I add, a Christian transfiguration or a pagan orgy? A bacchanalian revel of the categories in which not one member is sober, a protean flux of metamorphosis. Freedom is fire, overcoming this world by reducing it to a fluctuating chaos, as in schizophrenia. The chaos which is the eternal ground of creation. There is no universe. There is no one way. We are always in error, lost in the wood, standing in chaos, the original mess, creating a brand new world. Thank God the world can never be made safe for democracy or anything else. Meaning is new or not at all, a new creation or not at all, poetry or not at all. The newness is metaphor or nonsense, saying one thing and meaning another. It is, as Owen Barfield taught me, the legal fiction which liberates from the letter of the law and from the tyranny of literal meaning. A vast pun, a free play with unlimited substitutions. A symbol is never a symbol, but always polysymbolic, overdetermined, polymorphous. Freedom is fertility, a proliferation of images in excess. The seed must be sown wastefully and extravagantly. Too much or not enough. Overdetermination is determination made into chance. Chance and determination reconciled. Too much meaning is meaning and absurdity reconciled. Symbolism is polymorphous perversity. The translation of all of our senses into one another. The interplay between the senses, the metaphor, the free translation. The separation of the senses, their mutual isolation, is sexual organization, bondage to the tyranny of one partial impulse, leading to the absolute and exclusive concentration of the life of the body in the representative person. Knowledge is carnal knowledge, a copulation of subject and object, making these two one. And sex becomes, as Novalis said, not only an object of thought, but in some sense an imaginative method of comprehension. Polymorphously perverse sexuality, in and through every organ of perception, as Blake says, if in the morning sun I find it, there my eyes are fixed in happy copulation. Knowledge is carnal knowledge, a subterranean passage between mind and body underlies all analogy, and no word is metaphysical without its first being physical. The body that is the measure of all things is sexual. All metaphors are sexual, a penis in every convex object, a vagina in every concave one. In symbolic consciousness, thought and speech become resexualized, and orthodox psychoanalysis disapproves of this resexualization of thought and speech strongly. Orthodox psychoanalysis acknowledges still the reality principle. The truth is in schizophrenia. For example, the patient who refused to play his violin in public. Psychoanalysis can find nothing wrong. Behind every form of play lies a process of discharge of masturbatory fantasies. Nothing wrong except the refusal to play. When our eyes are open to the symbolic meaning, our only refuge is loss of shame, polymorphous perversity, pansexualism, penises everywhere, as in the tantric yoga, in which any sexual act may become a form of mystic meditation, and any mystic state may be interpreted sexually. Speech is to be resexualized, the tongue made potent again. Out of his mouth goes a sharp sword. Or the spermatic word, the word as seed. The sower soweth the word. Messages, annunciations, messengers, angels having intercourse with the daughters of men, making pregnant through the ear. Angels or birds, winged words or doves of the spirit. thought and speech resexualized. Symbolic correspondence is a marriage. The things beneath are related to the things above as man and wife. The thing then is to bring them together in a new conjunction, what the Hebrew scholars call a parallelismus membrorum, a rhyme, a couplet, or copulation. In puns, two words get on top of each other and become sexual. In metaphor, the two become one. What God hath joined, no philosophy can put asunder. Intercourse is what goes on in the sentence. In every sentence, the little word is the copula, the penis or bridge. In every sentence, magically, with a word, making the two one flesh. The little word is the hallmark of eros, even as Freud said, the little word no is the hallmark of death. Every sentence is dialectics, that is to say, an act of love. So they loved, as love in twain had the essence but in one. Two distincts, division none, number there in love was slain. Property was thus appalled that self was not the same. Single nature's double name, neither two nor one was called. Reason in itself confounded saw division grow together. To themselves, yet either, neither, simple were so well compounded that it cried, how true a twain seemeth this concordant one. Love hath reason, reason none, if what parts can so remain. Dismembered, remembered. Symbolism is not the apprehension of another world of archetypes, but the transfiguration of this world, and the transfiguration of this world is its reunification. Symbolism, says Freud, is the vestige and signpost of a lost, a prehistoric identity. The fall is into division, and the resurrection is to unity. Symbolism is the erotic or Dionysian sense of reality, restoring union. In freedom is fusion, Pentecostal freedom, Pentecostal fusion. Speaking with many tongues, many tongues, many meanings. The Babylonian confusion of tongues redeemed in the Pentecostal fusion. Many meanings dwelling together in unity because it is the unspoken meaning that they mean. Real unification is in the unseen unity. Unity at the level of the unconscious, at the level of symbolism. Pentecostal spirit is the principle of unspoken, unconscious unity behind the diversity of conscious tongues, a unity which is impersonal or suprapersonal, a unity in which personality is dissolved. Literal meaning is conscious meaning, a possession of the ego, a personal thing, a matter of personal self-assertion, contentious, divisive opinion or dogma. To seek unity through univocation is to assure disunity. The blessing of multiplicity rejected returns as a curse. Heresies and sects come from the literal sense of Scripture. Instead of the Pentecostal fusion, the Babylonian confusion, the battle of books. Fusion. It's a distinction between inner self and outside world, between subject and object overcome. To the enlightened man, the universe becomes his body. You never enjoy the world aright, says Traherne, till the sea itself floweth in your veins, till you are clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars. As in schizophrenia, what happens to the person's own body is identified with what happens in the universe. Fusion or mystical participation. Ferenczi said that the outcome of psychoanalysis was a return to a certain extent to the methods of ancient animistic science. Primitive animism is suffused with the unconscious identification of subject and object, participation mystique. Civilized objectivity is non-participating consciousness, consciousness as separation, as dualism, distance, definition, as property and prison, consciousness ruled by negation, which is from the death instinct. Symbolic consciousness, the erotic sense of reality, is a return to the principle of ancient animistic science, mystical participation, but now for the first time making it conscious. This was written with Owen Barfield's Saving the Appearances at my side. I am not sure, though, I have it right. Psychoanalysis began as a further advance of civilized scientific objectivity to expose remnants of primitive participation, to eliminate them, studying the world of dreams, primitive magic of madness, but not participating in dreams or magic or madness. But the outcome of psychoanalysis is the discovery that magic and madness are everywhere, and dreams is what we are made of. The goal cannot be the elimination of magical thinking or madness. The goal can only be conscious magic or madness, conscious mastery of these fires. There is a magic, there is a marriage in heaven between psychoanalysis and the mystical tradition, combining to make us conscious of our unconscious participation in the creation of the phenomenal world. I won't tell you where this quotation comes from. Neither man nor nature will ever be understood, though they may, in the meantime, be very skillfully manipulated, until we accept that nature is the reflected image of man's conscious and unconscious self. To become conscious of our participation in the creation of the phenomenal world is to pass from passive experience, perception as impressions on a passive mind, to conscious creation, to creative freedom. Every perception really is a creation. When we see physical objects, we really are makers or poets. The world is our creation. And as Blake said, the eternal body of man is the imagination. That is God Himself.
Our program, ladies and gentlemen, says discussion, on which I make three comments. Discussion is not required. Discussion is not always possible, but discussion is permitted. I shall therefore fulfill my function as chairman and ask the discussants on the platform whether they wish to address any questions or make remarks as a response to the address. Since for the time being, the discussants occupy the areas of silence between the aphorisms, may I invite members of the audience to address questions if they wish. Mr. Copeland.
In a number of instances, you spoke in self-contradictory expression. But the point, or the points which you made, I take, in a sense, denying your statement that there is no literal truth. I take it that you weren't trying to give some literal truth, though perhaps in non-literal types of language in some cases. How do you wish us to take your animosities at times toward literal truths or toward the principles of logic?
I don't know how to answer that. The question, well, did you hear the question? What was the question? I say there is no literal truth, is then my own statement literal truth or is it not? Am I not attempting to make literally true statements myself? And, if not, or something, how do I want the audience to take my hostility to literal truth? I don't know about the first one. I don't think the paradox there. I don't really. It's obvious. I don't really feel too bothered by it. I try to aim to get the maximum amount of nonsense in what I say, so as to prevent anybody being misled into thinking this is literal. On the whole, I thought I succeeded. I would not think that there could be any doubt that you were not that this was not an invitation to take this literally, and that I got that anything I said was. Not said. Anything I said was not said. It's working with the non-said. Literalists work with the said, and I'm trying to work with the non-said. That's fairly clear. The unspoken, which I take to be the same as the unconscious meaning in any sentence. I think if we go, if this discussion goes on for 3 days, I think it might be good. I hope there will be some direct consideration of the world of silence and what can be said and what cannot be said, and how can you say what cannot be said? It's not hopeless. I've made experiments in that, and that's not a self-defeating enterprise. Now, on the second question about how do I want the audience to take this, I can only say how I have come to write it. I think it's true so far as I understand my own psychology, but what do I come and do? I exhibit, come and bring you cases, fragments from a case history, which you can make your own interpretation of. But the fact remains that I think that translating my language, making these changes in my language from previous ways of speaking, and this raises a question which I'm much interested in the speaker tomorrow, who perhaps differs from this. I find myself inwardly turning towards not to dialogue. If you really read between the lines of what I spoke, if you say not the ego but the id, you say not the I-thou relationship but the it relationship, namely it or not I, not thou, but in the biblical term Christ in me, an it power in me, it speaks, not I. And therefore I speak insofar, I speak, I don't address myself, I think, to an audience, not in some... it seems to me, so far as I can honestly testify to the experience of starting to write this way, that some loss of self-consciousness is necessary, and that some loss of self-consciousness can only be attained by... well, as Dean Hopper was saying, by let it speak itself, or if you like a metaphor, pray all the time.
Is there another? Ms. Levertov.
But I was thinking. I think the confusion that you expressed comes from the common equation that the equation that most people commonly make between literal and sensuous. If one is equating the words literal and sensuous, then of course the poet loves the literal, but Norman Brown is distinguishing between the literal and the sensuous. Isn't that what he's not against the sensuous? He's for the sensuous, and he's against the literal as the anti-sensuous.
Could I, being a philologist, and it's part of schizophrenia to go etymologizing or punning, I mean, let's respect words if we're talking in an academy, and let's look at the letters in the word literalism. There's nothing sensuous about that at all. It's something to do with writing.
Well, I wasn't saying that one should equate
literal
and sensuous, but that people do.
I'm agreeing with you,
yes.
Absolutely. That it's a total lack of respect for the word literalism, the poetry of the word literalism.
But on the other hand, writing has to do with the word, and the word comes back to the sensuous. So I can contradict my own objection to that equation, because... those two words do reunite, in fact, in the substance of the word, the sound of the word. The word is written in order to be sounded.
Back to words spoken, and even, may I more precisely to say, perhaps words breathed. I was much taken by a part of Charles Olson's manifesto, where the whole technique of projective verse that is associated with his name is symbolically identified with the discovery. I have a decent modesty of talking about words in your presence, and I mean that seriously. But nevertheless, I would like to submit, there is other parts of my ideas here that might be relevant. I think that one has to think about these things very carefully, and there is a distinction to be drawn between written and spoken words, first of all, most immediately, between written and spoken words. And if, as I believe, if we get back to the, if we get back to the sensuous meaning, the sensuous bodily meaning of life and of words, we get back to words spoken, and even, may I more precisely say, perhaps words breathed. I was much taken by a part of Charles Olson's manifesto, where the whole technique of projective verse that is associated with his name is symbolically identified with the discovery that the line comes from the breathing. But the kind of words made new again, and made living words again, and made living breath again. And I'm too aggressive, but I for the present this whole business by opposing sensuous living breathed words to the words of the literalism. I use that as the opposite. Yes, take a long time, but not so long to suggest some images. I take it that Crazy Jane in Yeats's poems was schizophrenic. Read her talk with the bishop sometime. And above all, read the testimony of Yeats that he puts in her mouth. Nothing can be soul or whole that has not been rent. I take it that that is the suffering, the pathos of schizophrenia. I take it that schizophrenia in the whole, and look at the word, that schizophrenia is as close to crucifixion as you can come. It is crucifixion of the mind, or maybe of the mind and the body. If you want to animate a traditional image of crucifixion in the world today and leave out schizophrenia, I don't think it can be done. The suffering, that kind of suffering, is in crucifixion, is schizophrenia. Finally, I think it's very important if we overthrow the reality principle, and it's very clear in my intention to overthrow the distinction between sanity and madness.
And we all in our experience know that that line is an unreal boundary that does not exist there. But the consequences, linguistic and sociological, of accepting that have yet to be faced. How to speak after we have abolished the line between madness and schizophrenia. Finally, I think that Rilke and other poets taught me that the truth is not going to be found in the middle or in the safe, but at the extremes. And schizophrenia is one of those minds. Schizophrenia are people who are led by destiny or whatever to those extreme situations. Schizophrenics are suffering from the truth that we most of us don't are fortunately unable to see. And so in my attitude towards Crazy Jane, I regard on Crazy Jane absolutely as I regard the Delphic priestess.
Dr. Progoff.
Well, I had the feeling...
Use the microphone.
I had the feeling all the while listening to Professor Brown that he was speaking a truth, that a truth was coming through him that would perhaps come through less, more directly if he had not had the need to put this through the historical stage of psychoanalysis as a way of thought. And I've been toying with the way to put this idea here, and this last question about schizophrenia seems to make it more specific for me. Perhaps, do you know a book that was done in England by, I think under a pseudonym, John Custance, called Wisdom, Madness, and Folly, The Philosophy of a Lunatic, which is a very profound book. It has been published in the United States, I think, just in the sense that you were now speaking, in that it was the notes and the comments and records of a man who had had a mental breakdown, and so expressed his philosophy out of this splitting open of the psyche, that is to say, out of his schizophrenia, but who found that the experiences that came to him, he felt, were best described in terms of the conception of underlying principles of symbolism, that is to say, in archetypal terms, was the way he intellectualized it. And it had to do with this sense that when his psyche split open, that is to say, when the reality principle was broken apart, then he had the experience of sensing himself in connection with principles that are cosmic principles in the sense that they involve this mirroring quality of the universe that is in the psyche, in which the psyche of man is as a mirror of the cosmos, just as the cosmos or nature is a reflection of the human psyche, that is to say, back and forth in this way, and that in this experience of being split, this twofold, this dialectic unity became apparent to him. Now then, the thing is, it seems to me, that if one begins with a perspective of psychoanalysis, then one begins with a medical conception that is inherently pathological, that is to say, pathology-oriented in its frame of reference. But this is not your intention, as it seems to me. And this is not, I think, also the intention of the nature of the human psyche. That is, its intention is to reach toward reality through its own capacities. And it just comes about that in order for it to have this experience, this splitting has to happen. And then it happens that because of what is essentially the error of psychoanalysis, a judgment is made and a diagnosis is made. And then a term like schizophrenia is used, which misrepresents the essential condition of the psyche, that is to say, that it reaches toward reality through this splitting that happens. And this would mean, means to me that, is, that what I was feeling in the oracular style in which the talk is presented, that the oracular style is indeed essential, is essential. Empedocles knew it and Walt Whitman knew it. And I was feeling, well, here's a Walt Whitman, you know, who has read the classics. But that, and that also in this very important idea of resexualization, but you could also say re-spiritualization.
Yes.
And that the point is that sexuality, or the imagery of sexuality, is the most natural means of expressing the duality moving toward unity, which is the essence of the human spirit. But then why do this through psychoanalysis? You see, since what you're discovering is what Tantra discovered, and what we, the Tantric Yoga had to, or the Kundalini philosophy had to discover, and which apparently needs to be rediscovered in modern times in a diversity of forms, and can, it would seem, only be rediscovered through the experience of individuals who undergo this splitting apart and then permit it to be spoken.
Your comment is hardly needs any kind of, it's just and acute, and I don't have to attempt to, I'm not going to try to correct it or anything, but perhaps just utilize it as an occasion to say some things that, about my relation to psychoanalysis. I'm a case history of my generation and move from Marx to Freud. And when you do that kind of thing, I mean, you probably have to go through Freud, I don't know. But at any rate, that's the way it was. And I think it's fairly clear that at some, one does not have a choice of one's way. One has best go ahead. And if one goes ahead, I think one sees later on that some of the baggage one has to carry, the Freud baggage that one has to carry, can be thrown away. And indeed, I think that the allegiance of psychoanalysis to the reality principle and my theological quarrel with the reality principle makes some kind of gap there. However, I'm sure never until I die will I say no to Freud. And in reacting to the way you were talking, I'd just like to make two points that of what keeping in touch with Freud, not Jung, means to me. One is a conviction or a faith or something that you have to go down and stay down. That is to say that there is a principle of humiliation involved here. Humiliating, and that the process is pathologic. Even as Aeschylus said, we learn by pathos. And there's no alternative to pathology, and pathology we will always have with us. And secondly, I think that still, even for the students whom I'm in touch with, Freud is necessary in order, is necessary for many or most in order to stay in touch with the human body. That is to say, in Christian terms, with the absolute necessity of the incarnation of symbols, the necessity of seeing symbolic meaning incarnate in actual flesh and human body, with all that the human body is. This is something that I'm constantly helped to do by remembering Freud, and so far as I can see his usefulness in that regard, in a civilization which has no Kundalini yoga, etc., etc., it seems to me positive.
The question arises how one adjourns a meeting of this kind. First of all, one expresses gratitude to the speaker, but you have already done that. Secondly, one announces the time for the next meeting, which is 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thirdly, one makes a few acknowledgments to the address itself. A thesis has been presented, which I take it in the spirit of the address would be both true and not true. Second, an epigram is a half-truth so expressed as to irritate people who believe in the other half. Third, there was a poem written in the 20s called Caliban in the Coal Mines. Its concluding line was, "O God, fling us a handful of stars." Third, there is the anarchy of the apocalypse in the Book of Revelation. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. William Butler Yeats. Yeats took his inspiration from Nietzsche in the poem Second Coming. Nietzsche said, "Dionysus or the Crucified." Pascal said, "Les extremes se touchent, the extremes meet." Coleridge said, "Les extremes se touchent, the extremes meet." The Father and I are one. If silence was evoked, we should conclude with a benediction. May the darkness come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God, and the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. Or, as you sleep tonight, may stars like gingerbread, Brot und Wein, dance in your heads. But may the bread be broken, and may your heads survive.